On this episode of ID the Future, listen to part two of a lecture given by David Snoke at a conference sponsored by the Christian Scientific Society, hosted at Discovery Institute in November 2015. Dr. Snoke, professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Pittsburgh, discusses the relationship between information and entropy.
So in general, I've talked about information as a physical thing. So here I just happen to be reading through Physics Today earlier this fall. I mean, it is utterly non-controversial and universal in the physics world to say that biological systems contain information as a physical entity. That's not something highly controversial. So if you have, you know, blog trolls who are telling you otherwise, you know, it's just simply not the case. So for instance, in a non-controversial Physics Today article, scientists have long realized that living biological cells can be viewed as information processors. Some may even outperform our current technology. This is a non-controversial statement. Now, I'll sort of put my two cents in here. We're picking on Randy Isaac, but Doug Axe also brought this up. I think we may need a couple different terms here because we're sort of interchanging communication and information. So Randy Isaac argued that information is intrinsically related to communication, and particularly, as Casey mentioned, semantic information, you know, that there is a story being told, so to speak. And therefore, he uses that to argue against using information as evidence for intelligent design, because he says, begging the question, if you say there's information in it, then you're presuming an intelligence, because information only happens as communication between two intelligent agents. If that was how we defined information, he would be right. But I think in the physics world, that's not typically how information is defined. Information is not defined as communication. So I think the stuff that Perry was bringing up earlier is a really fascinating additional argument to make, to say communication is another thing besides information. So not all information is communication. So talking about communication might be a really productive way to start thinking. But I don't think it's synonymous with information. And, you know, you always have to be careful with roots of words, right? So it's true, maybe originally information came out of the root of to inform or to communicate. But I think in the physics world, it carries a lot of other meaning. So essentially, what I would say is the Shannon definition of information involves the selection of one of many possibilities. And so it's much easier to establish whether a physical system is selecting something than it is to say whether there's communication between intelligences. And so clearly, in many physical systems, one of many possibilities is being selected, and other possibilities are being removed. And that's, to me, the more intrinsic definition of information. Now, this is a point that oftentimes is confusing to people. Does high information correspond?
Can you go back to that last point?
Sure.
In a purely physical system, what does it mean to say, so there's obviously a course, if I spill the ice water out on the floor, there is a state that attains,
right,
not any other state. And mm-hmm. So is that selection or?
Not in that case, no. But you could say, you know, if like the garage door thing, right? If I push this button, this action happens. You know, if I push a different button, something else happens, okay? So would be an example. So, like, for instance, I'm going to come around to Maxwell's demon, which might help us to understand this. But say, suppose I had a computer with a visual thing looking at positions of things, and it's out there scanning, and it says, when this position obtains, do this action, and when this other position obtains, do some other action. Okay, so that's programmed in, but it's still selecting an action to do for a given position of the system. I think it might be easier when you come back to Maxwell's demon to understand that. Does high information correspond to high entropy or low entropy? Now, the way I define it, it looks like high entropy would be sort of synonymous with high information, right? Because it's log of the number in each case. But actually, it's not so simple. So information grows with the number of possible states. Entropy grows with the number of equivalent states. That's not the same thing, okay? So the selection process, whatever that is, makes one state out of all the possible states not equivalent. Right? So by definition, when it's selected, now if the information processing system can take macroscopic action in response to one state, then that state is no longer equivalent to all the others. And so we've got only one state rather than n equivalent states. The machine has basically selected one out of many. And so now its entropy, so its information is high, but its entropy is low. Okay? Because its entropy, now it has one selected state which is different from all the other states. Whereas if I looked at the entropy, it would be very low. More generally, selection doesn't always have to be to a single state. right? So you could say that if I'm looking at a vast number of possible states, and then I say, well, actually, 20 of them will all have the same response from my detector, okay, then that would say, well, I've reduced the number of possibilities, but I haven't reduced it just down to one possibility, and so I've got a little bit more entropy in the system. But still, in general, when I'm going from a large number of possible states to a low number of actual states that will give me that reaction, that is a huge entropy reduction. So in general, you could say the entropy before the selection process is the maximum amount of information that can be extracted, and the maximum possible amount of entropy reduction. So now, in general, this entropy reduction, I'll come back to this with Maxwell's demon, does not need to violate the second law, because it could be accompanied by an increase somewhere else. So for instance, a computer processor could be looking at a scene and taking actions on that basis, and then dumping heat to the environment somewhere else. So the fact that we have a local drop in the entropy does not mean that we're violating the second law of thermodynamics. But the selection process definitely reduces the entropy locally. So we have the kind of following scenario. We've got a monitored system with n macroscopically equivalent states. So think of this as, say, a gas with a bunch of particles bouncing around, and the states that we would define would be all the positions of the atoms. Then we've got an information processing system which is testing this or detecting it, looking at it. And now this system does something to select a response to one of these. So it's basically saying, I'll only respond to one of these states, not to all of them the same way. All right, and so when I say I'm going to respond to one of these a different way, then basically I'm selecting it, and now I'm having a single recorded internal state. And then I can make a macroscopic action, which says now that that state is macroscopically different from the other n states. Okay, so this is now a low entropy condition, not a high entropy situation. Okay, so Casey mentioned functional information. This is an idea I think that's really quite useful. I like the definition of functional information this way. Information is the number of ways to break the system. So, and break I'll define more technically as to dramatically or exponentially change the macroscopic function. So, for instance, suppose I have my memory register with 8 bits, and that exact 8-bit code is needed to provide some response to the system. It's going to turn on some switch or something like that. That means there's 8 places I could break it, right? If I change the bit value at any one of those points, then I've messed up its code and it's no longer going to have the same response. More generally, what I like about this is it allows information to be attributed not only to memory registers, but also to any information processing system. And a lot of ID people have pointed this out that, you know, with all these sort of computer game evolution things, people forget about all the information held in the computer. You know, you had to make the computer, you had to make the operating system, you had to make the mouse, you had to make all the things to run the program in the first place. And oftentimes they sweep that all under the rug and only worried about the last stage and the little app that they're running and how much information is in that. So, for example, I could say, is a car engine a high information or a low information thing? Well, if I take the hood open and I say, how many places could I break this? You know, so if I pull this plug out or if I punch a hole in this, will it cause it to break? There are many, many ways to break a car engine, right? On the other hand, it's very hard to break a pile of garbage, right? I could kick it around and do stuff, it's still a pile of garbage, right? It hasn't done much, right? And the same way, how many ways are there to break a living cell? This is what medicine is all about, right? There's lots of ways to break a living cell. Now, I have to distinguish. Lots of design systems have shields or shells to make it hard to break them, right? So another attribute of well-designed systems is that they are robust to external things, that they basically have a protective shell to prevent you from making all these little changes. But if you could get inside, you could do a lot of damage by changing a few little things. Okay, the famous apple peeler here. I had to bring this up, and so last night I was searching on the web for apple peelers, and actually, there's a lot of apple peelers out there. take your pick here. So one way to think about it then is to say, and this is a little bit like Behe's mousetrap thing, you know, how many ways are there to break the peeler, right? So if this was bent, right, then it wouldn't work. If it was missing the, this part or that part, you know, there's lots of ways to break this thing. And even I could say the curvature, so not just removing pieces, but I could say, well, you know, what if this wasn't as straight as that? Maybe it was curved, and I would have to, crank at a weird angle or something like that. And so I could evaluate the total amount of ways of breaking this thing. And there's another way to break it, and this was, I think, mentioned last night. I could take this and say, I'm going to reduce the information of this to the blueprints, right? And so now this is easy to quantify as information, because I can say now, you know, what's the actual amount of, bits in the JPEG that holds this blueprint? And then I could say, well, not all of that is actually crucial. And this gets to a little bit of the Kolmogorov thing, to say, well, suppose I make it, you know, coarse grained. And so at some point, if I make it too coarse grained, then I'm really losing the information, right? And it's no longer carrying what I need. And so if I keep making it more and more coarse grained, at some point I won't be able to rebuild it from the blueprints. And you could say, you know, the minimum number of bits needed to make a picture that would really let me build one of these things could be viewed as the information held in it. And in some cases, it might not just be the set of parts, but it also might be information about the process. Well, this has to go into this first, and then that has to go in second. It's not necessarily a static set of instructions in many things.
Stay tuned for more with Dr. Snoke. This has been ID the Future. Thanks for listening. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute, 2016. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org or idthefuture.com.